Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today, we're going to have, any minute now, a very special guest, Lenny Kravitz. You may have heard of him. And it's a nice opportunity because he's kind of between albums. I think he's working on his new album right now. And sitting down in a chair right now, I can confirm, wearing a really excellent sort of like black suede-y denim jacket that I want to know where he got it, is Lenny Kravitz. Hello, Lenny Kravitz.
What's that meant? That was good timing, huh? Just slid into the seat.
How you doing? I do
doing
like that.
Good, man.
I do love that jacket.
Oh, thank you. It's a beautiful day out, man.
It is lovely weather.
Yeah.
Lovely, terrifying
spring
weather.
Springtime in the winter.
Springtime for Trump land in February, you might say. So, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, do you still have a place in New York? You just moved out of...
No.
Oh, you don't?
I don't,
oh,
okay. No. I mean, I'm from New York. I lived here many, many years, as you know. But, I live between Paris and the Bahamas right now.
Got it. Okay. So, you've cleared out. Because I know you had a beautiful place that I think Alicia Keys now owns.
She's now out of it. Okay. And somebody else is there now. Yeah.
Okay. Who can keep up? Yeah. Real estate, man.
But she had it for a while.
Yeah. But do you still spend a substantial amount of time in New York?
Oh, yeah. I'm always in and out of New York City, yeah.
Got it. And why did you decide to leave?
I've always loved Paris. And I wanted to go for it. And I bought a house there like about 12 years ago. And the Bahamas, where I've been living on and off all my life, is where my mother and my grandfather were from.
Yeah.
So that's, those are my roots. And so I love spending time there. My studio's there.
In the Bahamas.
Yeah.
Do you have a studio in Paris as well?
Yeah, I have one in Paris as well, but the one in the Bahamas is sort of the main studio with the larger live room, but they're kind of sister studios.
And my impression is that your last album was Strut in 2014.
Yes.
And my impression is you're pretty deep into the next record. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I'm pretty deep into a couple of them, actually.
Uh-oh, okay.
Yeah. One that I'm finishing now, will come out this year.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling really good about it. It's one of those things that is just very inspired. I work best when the music just comes. I don't like to work for it.
Yeah.
Meaning I will work at it. I work extremely hard at it once I, started recording it. But I don't like to work at the writing. I like to dream the songs. I like to just hear them floating around.
Uh-huh.
And so when I pick those songs up and when I get a flow going like that, that's the best expression for me. Because it's something channeled as opposed to something that's crafted and worked on.
Right.
And so that's, I just went through a really good phase for the last month and a half where I was dreaming these songs. I wake up sometimes, 4 a.m. and I'm hearing a song in my dream. Wow. So, and then I just wake up and then I have to remember it.
Wow.
So either I have a thing next to the bed where I can put it down, or I run over to the studio and just start recording.
Since you play basically all instruments, mm-hmm. what would you start with? If you had a song idea and you ran into the studio, what instrument would you start with to lay it down?
As I'm recording, actually, not working on the song.
I guess sure, working on it.
Well, first I usually sit down at the piano or the Fender Rhodes or an acoustic guitar and work out what I've just heard in my head.
Uh huh.
And then I normally start with the drums to get the rhythm.
Right.
So I'll record the drums first, then a guitar or a piano or whatever the keyboard might be, and then bass. So then I've got a little structure, and then I'll do a vocal. And then I'll start to do all the other overdubs, whether it be orchestra, other guitars, whatever it may be.
You have songs come to you fully formed, like with chord progressions.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Sometimes they come partially.
Uh-huh.
And you have to find whatever, if you need a bridge, whatever, you find it. But a lot of them come complete, which is really, it's really interesting.
That's wild.
Because when it's all done, I finish recording and I listen back and I'm like, where the hell did that come from? You know, it's, you don't remember doing it. It's just kind of like it's done, and then it's like, wow, it's like a gift, you know.
That is no wonder you believe in God. That's you know, that's incredible.
You know, it's wonderful, and it's and that's the way I like doing it. So this album that I'm working on now is pretty much 8 songs in, so I'm gonna do 2 or 3 more, and then I have another one that I've been working on that I can't say too much about, but I'm gonna make a film to it.
Huh.
And then you'll know about that soon. But
interesting.
Yeah.
Is one? I mean, you were talking, I think, about an album called Negrophilia.
Yes.
Is one of
that? That's the film. Yes.
The film. Okay. Yes. So that's something you've been working on for a very long time.
Yeah. It's something that I've been working on. I put it away. I work on it. I put it away. And she's pretty much done now.
Mm.
And so I'm excited about that too. So it's nice having two things that are completely different, and that will be ready to go. So there won't be a break between the next two, and you know, after that, I'll probably be on the road for the next 5 years straight.
Hmm.
This is going to be a run.
So, do you think you're going to put out the first one this year, and then the
yeah, because then I have to film at the end of the year. Yes.
Got it. So it's all going to come up. The second one's like Purple Rain. You want it has to be all it has to be all the one thing.
Yeah, it's got, exactly. Yeah.
That's wild. That's wild. I mean, you seem to be on a pretty good roll musically. Your last two albums were really strong, and they're also released independently, which probably means you've always had freedom. But does it feel more free with no one to answer
to? I've always it didn't change. I mean, at Virgin Records, where I had the lion's share of my career, I had complete creative control, and nobody ever heard the albums until they were finished.
Yeah,
there was no A&R person coming in checking. It was really good. That was the one thing I made sure, beside other things and business points, but that I made sure that I had complete control. And the last two records, working independently with these distributors, one worked well, one didn't work as well as I wanted it to. There's far less money to spend in promotion, and things are different now.
Yeah.
Obviously they're changing every 5 minutes. but the last two records I'm very proud of, and Black and White America was a really strong record, and a fan favorite. People were really into that record, and then Strut was another one of those things that happened really quickly, where I was just channeling these songs whilst filming Hunger Games in Atlanta. So I didn't sleep for about a month. I was filming in the days, and then going to the studio all night until the morning. Yeah.
A song like The Pleasure and the Pain, The Pleasure, that's hard to say, The Pleasure and the Pain,
yeah.
The Pleasure and the Pain from your last record. I mean, that is a great song. I think Matt has it. Matt, you want to play a little bit of Pleasure and the Pain for a second?
It's been a while since you've come around. I missed you so, you broke me down.
That feels like, that's a song that would have been a standout song at any phase of your career.
Mm.
And there is a thing where it's like, because of the way radio is now, because whatever, like, that song isn't as famous as, like, some other songs. When that happens, is that frustrating, or is it just the way things are? You count on people to get to it, or what?
You know how pop radio is.
And I do.
It's it's a very small club. It's a club. It's an ageist club as well. And they played the same, 15 songs all day long, and I could easily say, well, okay, that's what I'm gonna go for, but I can't. I can, but it wouldn't be true.
Yeah.
Now, if something comes and it happens to work in that way, great. But I'm gonna make the music that comes through me, and I'm not going to worry about, what's going on today or, what people are doing or the style. I never did.
You never did.
In the beginning, I never did. I mean, when I put Let Love Rule out in 89, one thing that some people at the label were saying was that, you have to compete with what's going on the radio. And they, at the time, it, would have been, say, you know, Bon Jovi or whatever, you know, at that time, you know, and the, just to name one, not saying anything bad at all, but just saying that, you know, at the time it was, you know, the big gated drum sounds,
yeah,
and all the sort of hyped up sounds that were going on. And my record sounded really organic, really, you know, direct.
Yeah.
Didn't have effects,
right,
really, like that. And, you know, they would say, hey, but you got to compete with that. So you got to get the bigger sound and the whatever. And so, you know, I didn't.
Yeah.
But I've, you know, I've always been pretty much opposite of what's going on the radio.
Yeah.
And then when I started having the hits, you know, it started to change, actually change radio a bit.
Yeah.
You know, there were certain songs that hit that, you know, the radio station would later say, well, that opened up, you know, the vocabulary at our station.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it ain't over till it's over. I think, mm-hmm, I think that was your first top 10.
That hit, was the
right?
First, like, yeah, big, you know, pop that was number two with a bullet for, I don't know, a couple of weeks. And, yeah, it was Bryan Adams. He was number one with that, everything I do it for you. See how I remember that? And he had that, it was that Robin Hood movie,
yeah,
Kevin Costner. And they had big money behind that. And it was a great song. And so I had that number two with a bullet just sitting there, but that Robin Hood song wouldn't move. but yeah, but that was a song that actually I wasn't going to put on the album.
Huh.
Even though it was a very important song and a song, you know, that had a lot to do with what was going on in my life at the time.
Mm.
But I knew it was a hit.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I didn't want one.
Why?
I was in this place just like, it's a hit record. It's that thing when you're young and you're, you know, you're independent and
yeah,
didn't want to be part of that. But, you know, again, that song wasn't like what was on the radio.
No.
But I felt it. I knew it was a hit and I was going to give it away to somebody else.
Did you have an artist in mind?
I think at the time, because, you know, I was on Virgin and Paula Abdul was actually Paula Abdul's money, I was told, from selling all those records was why they could sign me and spend money on me. So I was like, let's give the song to Paula Abdul.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
I think I wanted like Smokey Robinson and Paula Abdul to do it as a duet or something.
Huh.
I remember telling Jeff Aroff, who signed me, and he's like, you got to put it on the record. It's really good. And God, this sounds so crazy, you know, but at the time in 91.
Yeah.
We still had the black side of the label and we had the pop side, which meant white pretty much. And, the lady who was the head of the black department really liked it as well, because it was an R&B song, sounded like a Motown song.
Yeah.
And so anyway, they persuaded me to put it on the record and there it went.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
So we are talking with Lenny Kravitz. This is Rolling Stone Music Now, and we'll be back with more in just a minute.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
We were talking about It Ain't Over Till It's Over, and then we got to listen to it a little bit, and it's really, I mean, talk about nailing a Motown vibe. I mean, and that's something you're able to do. You're almost, it's almost, you're almost too good at that if you want to. Yeah, you know, I would imagine it's a challenge to have that facility, because you can ape a style and then you're always able to kind of transcend it and make it into something new. But I think if you didn't make that extra effort, you're just too good at copying a vibe. You know?
I never, I mean, as you know, the basic, I don't think about it when I'm writing it. So I'm writing the song and then it just kind of happens, and it's just because of whatever your background is and whatever you're influenced by will come through, like any artist.
Yeah.
You know, that one's definitely got like a Motown-y kind of vibe. And then
Philly soul.
And then toward the end, it's got a little Earth, Wind & Fire with the horns. Actually, those are the Phoenix horns.
Nice.
At the end, playing the horn line. But yeah, it's just like, you know, what I grew up on.
Yeah.
You know? One of the things that I grew up on. I grew up listening to so many different styles of music.
How consciously did you study the music you loved, as opposed to just listening and vibing on it growing up?
I mean, that was my school, listening to records, man. That was the way to learn how to arrange.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Earth, Wind & Fire, Maurice White, I mean, my teacher, you know, Berry Gordy, my teacher, Jimi Hendrix, my teacher, Led Zeppelin, my teacher, Al Green, my teacher, Aretha Franklin, my teacher, Nina Simone, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis. I mean, every style of music.
Right. I mean, you know, for people who don't know, Duke Ellington and Miles Davis were actually like in your house growing up.
Yeah.
Not the records, the people. I mean, the records too, I imagine.
Yes.
Which is insane.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to, you know, my mother was an actress, and my father was a producer at NBC News, and he also was a jazz producer.
Hmm.
And so, you know, they were a part of the jazz world, and the memory with Duke Ellington was when I think I was about five, was my birthday, and we went up to the Rainbow Room where Duke was playing, and we showed up for the sound check, and he sat me on his lap while he sound checked and played the piano, and then they played Happy Birthday to me during the show, and Paul Gonsalves, who was his sax player at the time, you know, came right up to me at our table and played the sax in front of me, and it was amazing. And yeah, Miles Davis, you know, people that I grew up with. And
you said Miles was nice to you. I don't know how much interaction
Miles was really cool with me. I mean, he was a very intense figure, but he liked my mom a lot.
Uh-huh.
And you know, my godmother Cicely Tyson, and who was Miles' wife, and my mother were like sisters.
Wow.
And so Miles was cool with me.
Yeah.
And in fact, till the end, I mean, he got to hear Let Love Rule, and we actually were flying on a plane together the last time I saw him, flying from LA to New York, and he was on the same plane. He came up to me and he was telling me how much he liked the record, and he was so proud of me. And I said, well, I mean, I was of course blown away and really appreciative that he took the time to listen to the record and dug it. And so I said, well, I'm working on the next record now, Mama Said. And there's a song on Mama Said called What Goes Around Comes Around, which is kind of like has a bit of a jazz vibe, jazz soul vibe. And I told him I wanted him to play the solo. And he's like, yeah, cool. So and he ended up passing shortly after that. So that never happened, but I was really blessed to have that conversation with him on the plane.
Did having, first of all,
the pleasure and the plane.
Yeah, the pleasure. It's all been a journey through the pleasure and the plane.
Sorry, guys. That's because he couldn't say pleasure and the pain. He was saying pleasure and the plane. So we've been having a little bit of an inside joke during the commercial break.
My curse upon Lenny is that next time he sings it live, he's going to be unable to get the words out. So that's going to be my revenge here.
But see how it came full circle. Now we had the pleasure on the plane with Miles Davis. You knew what you were doing. You were setting me up, man.
It's all calculated. It's all a plan. So you grew up obviously in a world of creativity, mm-hmm. and where art seemed like an option. But at the same time, you said, and your dad supported like semi-supported your music. He helped you with studio time and stuff like that. But at the same time, I think you said that he was basically, this isn't going to go anywhere.
No, he came from a military background.
Yeah.
My dad was you know, in the Marines. He was like a sergeant. He was a Green Beret, you know, who are the seriously hardcore cats. And he, you know, so he had that military, very, he was a very strong disciplinarian.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was paying less attention to my schoolwork and more attention to music. And, you know, so I ended up moving out when I was 15 because we had a bit of a run in. I was trying to go see Buddy Rich play a concert and he didn't want me to go. And over that turned into this big fight. I ended up moving out when I was 15. And then later, you know, when I, cause I continued to go to school and I graduated high school because my mom would have had a fit if I hadn't graduated high school. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna at least do that.
Yeah.
And so they had money that they had put aside for my college, and I wasn't going to college. I knew from the time I was 5 years old that I wanted to make music. So I got them to give me a piece of that bread to go into studio time.
Yeah.
At A&M Records. Back when I, you know, was 18, and I made some demos, and
was that the Romeo Blue stuff?
Yeah, it was Romeo Blue stuff. Yeah, and it was a really great learning experience, and you know, I got to record the studio and you know learn all about that, and I worked with a great engineer, you know, I got to meet a lot of people, and it was like the beginning of everything.
Were you already proficient on all the instruments you're currently proficient on, or was it a gradual?
I wasn't at the level that I became later, but you know, I was still playing multiple instruments, but I always wanted to be in a band, so I always would get guys to come in.
Right.
And so later, now cut to doing Let Love Rule, which I did on my own. There was no record label when I was recording it. I wanted to, again, have people play. I wanted a band experience, even though I was a solo artist, and we couldn't find the guys that sounded right. We'd have guys come into the studio and play, and just didn't sound right over the microphones. You know, different players sound, you know, sound very different once you put that microphone in front of them. You know, some guys are great live or have a lot of excitement, but then you put that microscope in front of them, and all of a sudden it's like not so happening. And so my engineer at the time said, well, why don't you play the instruments? I've heard you play all the instruments. Why don't you do it?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. Like, that's no fun. Like, I want to have people in here.
Right.
And he talked me into it. And so I ended up trying it. And of course, I was into Stevie Wonder and Prince and, you know, Paul McCartney and folks like that who had played all the instruments on their records. Todd Rundgren, you know.
Sure.
Guys who are proficient at all the different instruments, and so I did it, and it worked, and it was just me in the studio with the engineers. It was very easy. I found it to be a little isolated, you know, because you know, I always had this fantasy in my head of, you know, you see all the pictures and the stuff in the recording sessions, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, and you know, all these people in the studio and the band and the girls and the thing, and it was just like me and the engineer, you know. It's like, this is a little boring.
Yeah.
But we focused, and I focused, and I ended up, you know, playing most or all the instruments on whatever songs, and that was Let Love Rule. That was the beginning. And then that sort of, that became my sound, so I continued doing it, and it's just a very fluid way for me to work.
Yeah. At the same time, you do like to bring in.
Oh, I'll bring in I mean, horns and things and orchestras and whatever. Just people that specialize in certain instruments. Yeah, absolutely.
You took an amazing amount of heat at the beginning, and then later about for being quote unquote retro,
which was funny because then later, bands were praised for the same thing I was dogged for.
It became
for.
The coolest thing, absolutely, in the early 2000s,
Yeah.
But at the same time, you were prescient in the sense that even in, like you said, Let Love Rule is like the least 80s sounding 80s record.
Yeah.
And you even hear like a McCartney record or whatever from the 80s, and it's all that, it's the gated snare, the synth, And I guess you heard early on, like, this is not gonna, this is gonna date stuff.
I knew for some reason why I was thinking about this. I knew it wouldn't age.
Yeah.
I knew it would just sound the same 50 years from then.
Yeah.
It would be what that is, just very pure. And, you know, all the records I've made, I think, really will stand, as far as that goes, as not sounding dated. The closest thing I did to anything kind of stylistically in the mix was Strut,
yeah,
which I had Bob Clearmountain mix, which was the first record that I didn't mix. And because I was really going for that sort of 1980, you know, Tattoo You, right. Let's Dance, you know, he did the Springsteen, you know, he did everything, did the Chic records before that. But I was specifically going for that sound, and it wasn't what I do. And he's the king of that. So I had him mix the record. So Strut has a bit of that sort of sound. But then again, when you put on, say, Tattoo You.
Sure.
That doesn't sound dated today.
Right.
I mean, you know, Tattoo You sounds just as amazing right now as it did when it came out.
It's a matter of taste as
you can't go too far.
Else. Yeah.
You can't go too far, you know.
And I noticed Bob Clearmountain was credited for hand claps, which means there must have been like one clap missing by the time he mixed it. What's that about?
Well, he's got some magic hands, man. He's clapped on some of the best. That sounded funny, right?
Yeah.
He's clapped on some of the best records, you know, in the universe. So we needed his hand clap, man. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, we're going to jump ahead to the 2010s for a second and ask about a line in Black and White America, which is a couple albums ago. When you were in a little bit of an Obama optimistic place, I think, at the time, and the future looks as though it's come around and maybe we have finally found our common ground. Do you feel less like that now here in 2017, or do you seriously, or do you maintain your hope?
I mean, I'm an optimistic person.
Yeah.
But I mean, these are some very interesting times.
Yeah.
That we're living in, and but I'll always remain optimistic. I mean, there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work to do, and you know, it doesn't come from the government. It comes from the people.
Uh huh.
The people have to really. I would hope raise their consciousness, you know, and know that we are all one people.
Uh-huh.
We all come from different places. We have different backgrounds, but we're all one people. And, you know, we can't keep this segregated vibe at all, you know.
Do you have specific concerns given what's going on, but given Trump, given the mood in America right now? I mean, does it change the way you think about things?
I mean, people are bugging out, man. You know, people are bugging out, and there's a lot of people that you know, aren't for the side that I'm talking about, and whether Trump is into that or believes, I don't know what he believes, really, but they've got their poster boy.
Yeah.
You know, and they're using that to elevate their negativity. But, you know, I really think that these times are going to be very interesting, because I think that some people are going to wake up. And I think that art and music and people's voices, their activism, I think that is going to get better.
Yeah.
You know, it's time, you know, we're meant to reflect the times. And so, you know, pop radio can't just keep singing about partying and chicks and the selfies and the phone and the thing and, you know, whatever. It's like we have to stop with all this narcissism, and we've got to, like, reflect the times and stand up for what's right.
I mean, it's interesting for some of us who have, you know, slightly longer memories. You know, even Let Love Rule came right after the Reagan era and into the first Bush, when it didn't seem like there was going to be any break from a conservative time in America. I imagine there was a element, even though as maybe not always explicitly political, but I imagine there was an element of reaction to that era just in where your head was at.
Yeah, and just where I've always been, you know. I do really believe in in the power of love.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in a household that reflected that, and you know, listening to Martin Luther King, you know, and I was, you know, small child.
Yeah.
You know, and so forth. I mean, I believe in those things. And yeah, it's pretty amazing that Let Love Rule would, like, if it was released today, would, it's like, wow, it's the same.
Yeah.
You know?
I remember you complaining, not complaining, but just sort of musing about the fact that in your own audiences, you wouldn't see that many black people. And you were wondering why. Has that changed at all over the years, or is it still a source of frustration, or
you know, it's become more. I mean, with the movement of, you know, alternative African, you know, things like Afropunk, and which I actually did last year, and it's getting more.
Yeah.
It's getting more. You know.
Well, I thought it was on the Grammys this year, the only two guys playing guitar solos were black guys. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
It's a nice reclamation of, you know, honestly, where this stuff came from in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting, and it feels like, but in general, I mean, you obviously had a song called Rock and Roll is Dead a long time
mm-hmm,
ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you complaining in the 90s that, complaining is such a harsh word. I remember you saying in the 90s that you were wondering where the musicianship was.
I sound like I'm Woody Allen.
You're kvetching. I didn't say kvetching.
What's going on here?
Where is the musicianship? But you
my last name is Kravitz.
That's true. But you were wondering where the musicianship was back then, and you know, obviously there's all sorts of forms of musicianship.
Yeah, I'm over that. But like, yeah. You know, I mean, expression can be made in any way, and if it's great, and if you feel it, it's great. Whether it came out of a computer or came out of a guitar, would I like that more young people are in, you know, into instruments, and you know, and. You know, that's why I really support, like, you know, kids that are, like, you know, in the orchestras and the bands and school, and think that's so important, you know, to keep that alive.
It's interesting that you're less conservative now, sort of musically, than you were as a young man, which actually I think isn't that unusual. I think people's minds sometimes open up the opposite
absolutely,
of the cliche, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
What was the breakthrough on that, when you kind of realized, like, maybe I'm being too hard
well,
on this?
Well, I think, you know, look, I'm only responsible for what I do and what I make, you know, and I love music made in all sorts of ways, you know. I mean, I listen to so many different things, and so it's really about the expression, regardless of how it was made, if you can play an instrument or not, if you can sing well or not.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the person who doesn't sing so well who has the heart.
Right.
You know?
What did you learn? I think you did at least two collaborations with Jay-Z.
Yes.
What did you take away from your time with him, both as like sort of a talent and a musician,
I mean,
and
we
a person?
Just sort of had this mutual respect for each other, and you know, we'd been around a lot of the same people, and you know, we're both from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And so which was the first? It was Storm, which was on Baptism.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was on
Then there's a Black and White America track.
That's right.
Yeah.
On Boogie Drop, right?
Yeah.
But I always thought it was really interesting to watch him work, because you know, I would come with the track and I'd go over to his studio and I'd bring it over, and he'd kind of put his head down and listen to it maybe twice, three times, and then he would just go in the booth and just see you later.
Yeah.
You know, he was really good like that.
Did it again, was it sort of a progression where you recognized fully recognized the artistry in hip hop?
Oh, I've always been
you
in
did.
Hip hop.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, I was in the hip hop from the first time I heard "The Bridge Is Over," man.
Okay.
Boogie Down Productions, you know, "The Bridge Is Over." No, I've always, I mean, I remember in Bed-Stuy on my block on Kosciuszko Street, seeing the first like guy that would bring out these like homemade, you know, big speakers in his turntable.
Sound system, yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is he doing with the record player? Mm. I was like a little kid, you know? So, no, I've always been into hip hop, yeah.
but you just, it was just.
But I hadn't incorporated it in my music per
se. Fair enough.
But you know, at that time, you know, it's 1989, 1990, and I think every journalist expected every black musician to be a rapper or a hip hop artist. And you know, I'd be over in Europe and I'd be doing interviews and they'd be like, why don't you rap? Why aren't you doing hip hop? Like,
where is
like,
the rap?
Like, you're black, you're from New York City, you're from Brooklyn, what's with the rock and roll?
Right.
You know, and the soul and the whatever. I mean, soul, maybe they understood that, but I was asked that for so many years in the beginning. Like, they just couldn't understand why I wasn't rapping.
I think the word for that is racism, actually, but that's okay. I think that's what they call that, but that's okay. Yeah. I guess. So you've also, you know, you talked to Rolling Stone last year about you had a very long association and friendship with Prince.
Yes.
And I think we're all kind of absorbing just with him and Bowie. It's like these losses, even for us who did know them or just interviewed them once or twice. It's like a progression, like any other kind of mourning.
It was a lot for me because before knowing either of them, you know, when I was coming up, what I wanted to do was sort of in my head when I was, you know, 18 years old, was I want to be a combination of Prince and Bowie.
Yeah.
Which I don't know that I became any of that, but that was like my thing. And I knew everything about both of them. I listened to all their music. I read Bowie's books and da-da-da-da. And then I ended up knowing the both of them and working with Bowie, working with Prince. I got to know Prince much closer than I did Bowie, although we were cool. But I saw Prince more, and Prince and I had, you know, a lot of things in our lives that were, you know, that would have brought us together.
Yeah.
And, it was rough, man. It was rough. I had a lot of love and respect for that guy. And he, you know, when I was in high school, he was the artist that, you know, because obviously I would have been into Jimi Hendrix and all these people, Sly and the Family Stone, Funkadelic, all this great music, James Brown. But here was a guy who was young right at the time I was in high school that was right there. He was fresh. His music was coming out.
Yeah.
And I could look to this guy and say, wow, not that I can do that, but he's showing me where it can be taken.
Yeah.
And how unique he was and how different he was as an African American artist.
Yeah.
You know, compared to the other ones. And so he was just like this shining example for me of what you could do.
Yeah.
And what boundaries could be pushed down. And then after my first album, he reached out to me. He called me for a meeting, wanted to meet me, and we met and we stayed friendly, and you know, until the end.
It's weird. I mean, even you know, I got to spend like one day with him at Paisley Park about 2 years before his passing, and you know, one of the things was, it was an amazing day, but one of the things was that people asked me, you know, did you see any sign that this was a guy who had any kind of addiction? And I said, absolutely not.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
So it's such a strange, and that's what a lot of people around him say. So it's kind of a mystery. I think he was
so healthy. Every time we'd go out to eat, you know, he'd be having this little soup or a salad, or, you know, he didn't really drink much at all. He'd have these little drinks, and it was really healthy. You couldn't bring meat into Paisley Park.
Right.
You know, or alcohol even. I remember because when I was there, you know, filming a concert with him, my cousin who was working with me at the time snuck some Jack Daniels in, and he got banned from Paisley Park for like life. That was it.
Yeah.
And you couldn't even eat meat on the premises.
Mm.
You couldn't bring it in. I didn't see it.
Yeah, so it's just kind of the one.
And I can normally smell that stuff, you know.
Yeah, it's baffling. It's baffling, actually, because it must have been anyway. It's and then Bowie, what was, I mean, you work with him, but what was your kind of best moment with him? What stands out in your mind?
Well, I played a guitar solo on one of his albums, on The Earthling, and but that was great. But you know, we sang together live. You know, we hung out several times. You know, we were both on the same label for a minute.
Right.
But he was a really amazing, interesting guy, and just, you know, Bowie for me, I was into his records when I was a teenager. I remember, this is so funny, I was auditioning at the time because I was still trying to do like theater and movies and stuff. I was auditioning for Spike Lee's School Days.
Wow.
And so everybody's coming in with their tapes, you know, and girls, every girl is singing like The Greatest Love of All, bringing in her tape, and guys are singing whatever. I don't even know what standard they were. And so I come in and I had no tape, and they said, okay, what are you going to sing? I said, I'm going to sing a cappella. What are you going to sing? I'm going to sing Life on Mars by David Bowie. And I began to sing in front of this panel of people, the casting agent, Life on Mars. And I mean, when I was done, it was like, you know, Daffy Duck, when he does it, da, 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 and it's like crickets. It was crickets, man. I sang Life on Mars, and they were looking at me like, who the hell is this kid?
Clearly from,
And what is this song?
Right. Yeah, but, this dude is from Mars.
Yeah, yeah. I was into him from my early teens, man.
So
taught me so much.
Yeah. So, you know, I was thinking about the fact that you managed to come up in an era before social media, before reality TV, but sort of just before, because you've obviously coincided with it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you've been able to do is coming up was have this old fashioned sort of rock star mystique.
Mm.
You know, do you think that would be harder to cultivate or maintain in this era of total transparency and scarf photos going viral and all that shit?
I mean, people just, I still stay under the radar. You know, I show enough.
Right.
I show up enough, but then I go away.
Well, there was that one concert where you showed.
That
aside. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a whole other dynamic now, man. People just want to show everything. There's no mystique, and I think it's boring.
Yeah.
It's too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the old-fashioned idea of a rock star...
Let people miss you.
Yeah.
You know?
Was the old-fashioned idea of a rock star important to you? Did you want to get that... cop that vibe of like...
I mean, I wasn't trying to do anything, and I still don't try to do anything. I just live my life. But I did grow up seeing these people.
Yeah.
And I saw how they were. And the mystique is what made it... It was so interesting when... The only time you could see your favorite artist was either when they were in concert... Or when MTV finally came, you'd stay up all day waiting for their video,
right.
You know, or you'd see them on the cover of a magazine, or you'd see them on a TV show, you know, an American Bandstand or a Soul Train or whatever. That was it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you didn't see them. You had to look at it, you know, get your little fan magazines or whatever, and then buy your tickets, and you'd wait in line for your tickets, and, you know, go see them in concert, and this is, you know,
bigger than life
before screens, so that like you actually, whether you were in the nosebleeds or you, that's how you had to focus on them. And there's something that I think was really magical and beautiful about that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just romantic, but I like that better.
And in the couple minutes we have left, I know you have Negrophilia, which is a little harder to talk about. It's the album with a film project attached. But the other album, the one that's coming this year, mm-hmm. can you tell just a little bit more about that in the next minute or so?
No.
40 seconds worth?
It was dreamt. I tell you that.
It
was dreamt. The album's definitely a succession of just dreams, you know. Musical dreams.
Style-wise, do you have a sense of it?
Style-wise. Cinematic. Open. Anthemic.
Okay.
Is that good?
Anthemic is good.
Yeah.
Working on something like that, do you think, like, I need these songs to work live? Does that get in your head?
No. When I'm in the studio, I'm completely just thinking about the music.
That's good.
And whatever it is. And then after I'm like, okay, how am I going to do this live? Or that song won't work live and this one will, or, you know, but you never really know till you put it in front of an audience. But in the process, I'm not, because these songs are dreamt, they just become what they want to become.
You don't have a producer in your dreams, and you're your own producer anyway, so
yes,
it's all good. Lenny Kravitz, thanks so much for being here.
It was a pleasure, man.
I really appreciate it. So this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. Come back and join us again at 1 p.m. next Friday on Volume, and download us as a podcast on rollingstone.com/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. And have a great week, and we'll see you next time.